This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 008. On the show today, I'm delighted to welcome Richard Gould of international lawyers Ragg Lawrence Graham. Richard chairs the firm's global tech sector group and spends several months a year visiting San Francisco, New York, and Boston. Ragg Lawrence Graham are the premier fintech lawyers in London. I first came across Richard's name in the London Financial News 40 Leaders in Fintech list of folks who are, and I quote, shaping the future of finance in Europe. I think my disposition hadn't been helped by previously reading a well-written, if acerbic, piece talking about PR-dominated lists. Against this background, I rather shuddered when I saw a lawyer on the list. A lawyer? Over the course of researching and doing these podcasts, though, I've come to see London FinTech's great strength as, shall we say, stage one of the startup journey. That is, being able to rapidly turn ideas into a product. However, the bleeding edge, and what I see as a key deficiency right now, is stage two, the ability to turn a product into a business. This requires a far more 360-degree perspective, from the 180 degrees above the waterline, product, marketing, sales, client development, to the 180 degrees below the waterline of infrastructural support for all the above the waterline items. When I came to meet Richard, I met someone who has a long and deep expertise in working with companies, not just on this stage two development of a product to a real business, but also in the later stages of what we might call a real grown-up company, for example, M&A, IPOs, and so forth. Furthermore, Richard embodies the best of what I see as the old and new city virtues. Old virtues in terms of integrity and what used to be the old-fashioned company lawyer slash non-exec approach, someone who helped companies across a broad waterfront, even if they monetized only a part, for example, with legal work in this case. He embodies new virtues in terms of really walking the walk in terms of how he can help folks and the fintech sector, very much the 21st century freely give to receive paradigm. So Richard fully deserves a place on any list, and I'm looking forward to drilling into some of his background and understanding of what it takes to make a real business out of a startup in this global fintech scene. So let's get on with the show. Hi, Richard. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Mike. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. As you know, this is an area that I feel absolutely passionate about.
That's good. And even more so, you've got wonderful offices overlooking Tower Bridge, and it's a really sunny day up here. So it's a perfect day for it. Before we dive into your passion for fintech, and I'm very passionate about fintech as well, at least some days of the week, what led you to where we are today in these nice offices overlooking the mayor's office?
So I started doing a maths and business degree originally from Manchester University.
When you say you started, you mean you didn't finish the degree? Or?
I both started and finished my degree at Manchester University doing maths and business. And I actually thought I was going to go to work in the city. Both my wife and I were both going to become investment bankers. That's what we thought we'd go and do. And then I found my firm. I found the firm that is now Ragg Lawrence Graham & Co. And I found a firm that I decided just on doing a work placement was somewhere that I wanted to have my entire career. And so far, that's panned out.
Oh, that's really cool, because in terms of the fintech scene, there is this polarization between the suits and the t-shirts. Today I'm wearing a suit, although you're wearing a jacket, actually, so I can't say I've got a meeting of two suits. And so much of what one reads is so polarized. Small startups are good, big companies are bad, or big companies are going to win, small companies are bad. But it's always useful for us all to remember that being big or small doesn't really make a difference. You can be a great big firm or a rubbish big firm. You can be a great startup or a bad startup. And certainly, there are a lot of benefits, particularly in the legal side, of course, of being a large firm in terms of the resource and expertise and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and what we're trying to bring to bear is very much the full suite of connections. That's the language I try to push throughout the whole firm. It's leveraging the connections, not just doing the law, but trying to actually help bring contacts and business nous to what our clients are doing.
Yes, and as I said earlier, although it's probably only people of my age who would see it this way, the old city was pretty much like that, you know, and the merchant banks, the non-executive directors. When I was just starting the firm, I thought, what are they there for? They didn't know much about financial services. But that wasn't the point. Yeah. The point was they knew a hell of a lot about business. And they could provide this 360-degree context. So that's kind of in the old way of looking at it. But then, as you say, in the new way of looking at it, and we must come on to your American experiences, what works really well in San Francisco slash the Valley, of course, is the whole connections. And what works very well on the interweb is is networking and connections and that kind of thing. It's just a little harder to do well than it sounds. So, you know, again, not just to sort of blow smoke up you guys, but I think it was a misconception of me, and it still is a misconception of others, to think, oh, these guys are lawyers. Well, of course you're lawyers. That's the day job. But actually, what makes a firm like yours or the other firms who are good in the sector and add value is actually they know a hell of a lot of tech and they know what makes firms grow and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, your interest is in seeing your clients go.
That's right. And what we have been trying to do, particularly over about the last 5 years, as we've been trying to put ourselves as a hub for the fintech community. If I look at my career today, I've spent a lot of time doing the nuts and bolts, you could call it, of a corporate partner's job. I am a corporate partner, that's the day job. I help companies raise money, I sell them, we work on the IPOs. We've got the biggest IPO practice in London by market capitalization.
So just stopping on that, because you always hear that, oh, what London needs is more IPOs. Have we had many then so far?
I think one of the problems with the UK tech scene generally, but the fintech scene specifically, is we haven't had a properly functioning capital market for some time, actually. One of the reasons why New York has pulled away from London, in the tech space at least, is twofold. I think they've had some really good exits, more exits than we've had, and they've got a really well-functioning capital market. NASDAQ is working more efficiently than we've seen the UK markets, but that is changing. And AIM in particular is coming back online. Pricing when AIM opened again 18 months ago, 2 years ago, was just crazy because there was a pent-up investor demand. That led to some overpriced IPOs. That's then led to a bit of investor indigestion, you could call it. And now we're into a period of normalization again. So when AIM in particular starts to operate properly, begins to become a bit of an exit route for the VCs that are backing these fintech companies, then we will genuinely have a more fully functioning fintech ecosystem here.
Right. Well, let's return to that very important theme towards the end of the show in terms of what, with your experience, you feel is needed in the fintech scene in London in order to help the companies get to the stage where they can start thinking of listing and big things like that. For now, one thing I want to do, just sort of touch on in terms of your depth of experience going backwards, as the fintech scene as such is relatively new, is that in the past you did a lot of stuff for 3i, and I can't remember off the top of my head how far 3i goes back, but it wouldn't surprise me if it was the sort of Labour government of the 1970s and Tony Benn and that.
Second World War.
Oh, there we go, even further. Yes, well, that was before I was born. Yes.
Yeah, the Bank of England set up what became 3i and went through various iterations after the Second World War to help build the SME economy post the war. Investors in industry is what the 3i's stood for. And
oh, I'd forgotten that. III.
So I started my career actually doing deals just for 3i. When 3i was the biggest investor in technology across Europe, I spent time...
So roughly, when is that then? When were you doing that?
Almost 15 years ago now.
Okay. So just pressing the pause there, just to get my highlighter out, which I like to do occasionally in these episodes. It's worth highlighting, given that how young the fintech scene is, given what the fintech scene has as deficiencies and what it needs, somebody with 15 years experience of seeing tech companies grow up, fail, do successful things, do the wrong things, it's really valuable, isn't it?
Well, I think...
I mean, you're supposed to say, yes, I'm wonderful at that point.
Pause, next question.
And so what, if you can sort of generalise from your sort of 3i experience, because they are the longest running funder of tech in Europe, were there any themes that, or things that you think were done particularly well in those days that could be done now?
Well, I think what the European VC market lacks is not necessarily a 3i, because I think 3i had its own challenges. What 3i became was really a combination of several things: a very large buyout house, a growth capital house, and a VC house, all on the stock market, and the stock market wasn't particularly responsive to the various different models, didn't understand that diversified portfolio. The VC arm, though, was run well. It might not have had the returns of the growth capital or buyout house, but Europe needs a big volume VC that actually puts money into a large amount of A rounds across Europe. In the US, there's an incredibly diversified VC community, and many of the VC houses in the US have done incredibly well. I think in Fund 1 and Fund 2 and lots of VC houses in Europe, there haven't been the stellar returns. And indeed, somebody told me just last night, an investment banker told me just last night, that they had done a piece of research that looked into Fund 1, Fund 2 VCs across Europe for about the last 15 years. And the median IRR is just over 1%. Some of the VCs have done incredibly well.
1% isn't very much, speaking as an ex-investment manager, is it?
Well, you look at the growth capital and buyout guys, and they're sort of in the 15 to 20% IRR territory. Yeah. So it's a pretty poor return compared to US VCs who can have IRRs of 30, 40, upwards to 50. Yeah.
Let's again return to what needs to change on the ground to change those dynamics, because it's not just a question of putting cash in. If you pour water into a leaky bucket, it just disappears. I mean, I should have mentioned before that you're the chair of the fintech practice, but actually the tech team here is 120 lawyers, so there's a hell of a lot of expertise. A hell of a lot of expertise. And you do, as you were just telling me before we started, you do spend a lot of your life on aeroplanes and going around America and things like that. So just, can you give us a flavour of where the San Francisco / the Valley's at, New York, and you mentioned Boston as well. I wasn't so aware of Boston myself.
Yeah, so tech for us covers a wide range. I'm particularly involved in fintech, but across those 120 lawyers, they will go into all manner of tech, from tech that you can touch and feel to very intangible tech, and there'll be strengths in different places. But if I just take a very high-level view on particularly San Francisco and New York, one of the key differences, and I think something that continues to drive their tech economy faster and harder than particularly the London scene is being driven, is that if you look at the VCs and if you look at the incubators, many of the people that are behind those organizations in the States are successful entrepreneurs who've made money. Yep. They've built 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, however many companies. Some will have failed, some will have succeeded and made them very wealthy. And what they want to do then is become mentors, become incubator leaders, become VCs.
Yeah.
And that is a skill set is pretty rare in Europe. You know, Mike Lynch, post-autonomy, is now going down that route, but...
when he's not getting bogged down with lawyers playing ping-pong with HP, which we'll reserve judgment on. Yes. I only read the newspapers on that, so I've got no idea who was right and who was wrong.
Yeah, but, you know, but Europe needs to have people like that, because it is amazing that we are at the start of a pretty transformational phase in the tech economy in Europe. The fintech scene, I think we are... Eddie George made this point. I think we're probably 1, 2, possibly 3 years into a 10-year cycle. Yeah. There's a lot of heat, there's a lot of froth, but actually the more people that successfully build IPO companies or build sell companies and then still have the passion and drive to throw themselves into a second business and mentor and angel invest on the back of experience that takes them around the world.
Yeah.
And that's what happens in San Francisco. That's why they have such a dynamic tech ecosystem. The tipping point for New York, because New York's quite similar to the London ecosystem in many ways, I think the tipping point for New York is when there were some really big exits. So you look at the Buddy Media sale to Salesforce.com for $700 million. Then that's just one example, but Mike Lazzaro, the CEO of that company, then sets up his own VC fund, in addition to leading big division for Salesforce.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really powerful. It gives young entrepreneurs vision as to what it takes to build a company, but it also puts an incredibly knowledgeable resource back into the market.
Yes, I mean, there were a couple of things that always strike me, as you say, about the early stage we're at in London. And in 2014, we've had this explosion of incubators, accelerators, and the like, is that we've transported implicitly or de facto, without thinking about it very much, two aspects of the San Francisco scene, which I think aren't really working. And I think these are two components that have to be changed, in my opinion, in order to get the companies from product to business to then a real grown-up business that can do things for big figures. The first, and I discuss this in more detail in episode 005, is the kind of implicit idea that innovation is something done by teenagers. So lots of incubators have got ping pong tables and bean bags and all that kind of thing, which is a little bit childish, perhaps. Now, there's nothing wrong with that per se, but what is implicit there is that what they haven't really factored out is that in Silicon Valley or in the West Coast, you can create a tech startup as a 17-year-old that's incredibly successful and turns into a billion because you know what other 17-year-olds want. You've got great domain expertise in the 17-year-old sector. If you're doing something technical, and a lot of financial services, particularly given the regulation, is incredibly technical these days, then you haven't got a clue at 17. And the kind of people with 10, 20 years experience of financial services, they don't want to sit on beanbags.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing. And then the second thing, which, I mean, as we've talked before, there's a lot that I hear that I'd love to say, but I can't say on the podcast in terms of people sort of gossiping and talking about how things really are. The second is that all of these incubators / accelerators, or actually not all, even all of them, certainly accelerators perhaps, have mentors. And shall we say the quality varies enormously. And on the West Coast, your average mentor in one of the successful places, as you say, has probably done a 9-figure exit already.
Yeah.
So, wow, I can learn from that guy, as opposed to the mentors. Somebody said to me recently, who's created a very successful firm, which has been written up in all the mainstream media, I won't mention his name. He was somewhere recently with mentors, and their only qualification was that they were a mentor somewhere else.
Yeah.
What's your feeling on that? You know, those two areas in terms of domain expertise, where we're implicitly assuming that you don't need much, whereas I feel that for the professional market, you certainly need a lot, and then also the mentoring thing.
Yeah, so what we're seeing in London right now is a very diverse ecosystem. So right across tech, there are very different requirements for consumer internet businesses, as you allude to, require a different skill set and often a different personality to a fintech company. Personally, I really like the 360-degree perspective that you talk about. So above the line being things that are market-facing, below the line, the cornerstones of the business, the building blocks. Mm. Often in the fintech companies, the building blocks are significantly more complicated,
yeah,
significantly more costly to get right, because you've got to have things like regulatory capital, you've got to engage with a regulator, and you can't just mess about with those sorts of things. Are one of the things that I think our country is doing incredibly well is making the red tape lighter,
yeah,
than anywhere else in Europe, making the regulatory framework lighter. But nonetheless, unless you get your building blocks right, then you can't build a seed company to an A company, irrespective of whether or not you can raise the A round. You certainly then can't build a global beating company. And I think that's attracting a different type of person to Tech City. And for my money, this is one of the reasons why I genuinely believe that we here in London can build a world-beating ecosystem. You know, I spend a tremendous amount of time, as you've mentioned, in the States. I was in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago. I'm in New York in a couple of weeks' time. And it is frustrating that I spend a lot of time speaking to Americans who constantly espouse the virtues of their own tech ecosystem. And they kind of talk about European tech as potentially interesting, but
A little sideshow.
It's clearly undervalued, and maybe they'll put some money over there because it is undervalued. But actually, what they miss, I think, is some of the amazing things that are happening here. And in some subsectors, fintech in particular, I think we have better cornerstones than even in the States to build a fintech ecosystem. The regulatory framework, the law, the fact that so many global investment banks and retail banks have their either headquarters or their innovation centres or their technical centres here in London, and lots of people have fallen out of those centres or of the organisations generally and want to do their own things, but then know how to tap into the Square Mile or Canary Wharf. If you combine all of that with just what London has to offer anyway and what is going on in the tech ecosystem here, I think that London could pull away from New York in 2, 3, 4 years' time for the quantity and quality of the fintech companies that are here. Really, it'll be good to be able to have something to espouse lyrically to the Americans on that topic with anyway.
I can imagine, and I certainly agree with you. I think we've absolutely got the potential literally to be world beating. I think at the moment I'm just a little bit nervous that in the absence of spotting a couple of glaring deficiencies, we are going to be a little bit handicapped. Coming back to London as the centre, we all tend to slip from FS into banking, but of course FS is a very wide sector. And one of the things that many people don't realise sufficiently is that Lloyd's insurance market is the centre of the global wholesale insurance. So much so that anybody in London, all those big buildings you see being built around it, are the American big insurance firms bringing their capital to London. And that's the only example of a market where it is still centred here and where it always has been centred here. So there is a lot of strengths that we have.
Yeah. On your second question, Mike, about mentoring.
Gosh, you've got a good memory.
I
can't even remember my breakfast, let alone my first question.
So I have mixed views, I guess. My primary view is that the energy and enthusiasm that is in the tech ecosystem generally and the fintech ecosystem specifically is amazing. It's unlike anything I've seen in the UK, any part of the UK economy before. So we've just closed an EIS round for a fantastic company. And the entrepreneur there had been approached by not quite hundreds, but probably up to 100 of different people who could offer business services, legal advice, general mentoring. And the really good entrepreneurs, I think, can pick their way through the wheat to the chaff. And okay, maybe there aren't as many people who have been around the block, built companies, worked on them through to the half billion sale, billion sale or whatever. But actually, the fact that people really do want to get stuck in is a bit more like the entrepreneurial spirit that actually is part of the reason why the US is so successful. So I think overall, it is a good thing, and the ecosystem will develop over time. There are certainly some really good people in the market that are doing amazing jobs of mentoring.
Absolutely. I think the one thing which is rebooting, and London's strength we haven't touched on, is the entrepreneurial spirit, which has been somewhat deadened by a century of kind of increasing corporatism in the UK. So going back to the vibe and that, one of the places I like to hang out is actually the Google campus, which isn't specifically fintech and is definitely at the young end of the spectrum, but they do a very nice burger on a Friday lunchtime. And the vibe there is, you know, a bunch of young folks really just trying to do stuff and make things happen. And, you know, they've got the campus education program. I've been to a couple of their sort of Fridays and have a whole bunch of interesting speakers. And it's amazing value as it's free. But there is such a feeling of life there.
Yeah.
Compared to if I just then walk into the sort of centre of the city, which is sort of dusty and dirty and people are shuffling along. So there is this whole vibe. And one of the things which is really driving that vibe is, well, let's frankly call it immigration. You go to Google campus, there's a lot of people who in the old days you would call foreigners. But it's London's centre of an empire, as we used to be. And this whole cosmopolitan attitude, you know, it is very open. It is very liberal. It's actually quite nice to hang out with a whole bunch of different folks from different backgrounds and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, there's a whole debate around where the future technology hub for Europe is going to be, because Berlin is so much cheaper than London, has got so much going for it, and therefore immigrants, some would say, would be more likely to go there, particularly from some parts of the world, Eastern European developers in particular. But for my money, London will continue to be the main European hub. There will be centres of excellence across Europe, so consumer internet businesses in Berlin, for example, or mobile or e-health businesses in Barcelona, for example. But I think London has got it all. London will always be London, the amazing city that it is, that draws people from around the world. They don't mind living in smaller flats. And also the ability to attract international business, international capital, and have access to an international audience, particularly in something like fintech. It will blow all other European business centres out of the water for the fintech ecosystem that you can build.
You should work for the London promotion office, Richard. I mean, maybe it's the fact that you're overlooking Boris Johnson's office every day that you absorb the vibe coming from there. I wouldn't disagree with you. You mentioned the EIS, SEIS thing, which for those who don't know is a very, very tax efficient way of raising 150 grand, at least for the investors. One of the things that we touched on briefly before was this thing that's known as a funding gap and has been known as a funding gap for a long time, going back to 3i's. So just very briefly, for those of the people who don't know, basically if you turn up to an incubator or something like that as a fintech, you can get 20 or 30 grand relatively easily as long as you've got a good story to sell to them. You can then raise some money, 150 grand in, oh, I've forgotten, SEIS, and you can do the EIS or vice versa. You'll know and you can explain. Then actually one doesn't hear much about funding until quotes there in the Evening Standard and I say, oh, that company's raised $2 million or $25 million and that kind of thing. And I've never quite yet met anybody who's explained to me clearly what the kind of Indian rope trick is in the middle to suddenly go from one day you're raising 150 grand and then the day after next you're raising a few million.
So there is one school of thought that there is no funding gap, that actually the best entrepreneurs will always find their way to the money.
Cream rises to the top.
Right. And there is a bit of that.
Probably explains why I've sunk over my entire career, but never mind.
The reality is the availability of A round finance. So for those who don't know, typically your seed round is the $500,000 to up to $1 million where you're actually building the product. Your B to C rounds are sort of growth or expansion capital where you've actually got a product that's rolling and you're actually then scaling it. So the A round is quite a critical round that sits in between product development, proof of concept, a bit of that, then taking it to the market and beginning to get traction. So it tends to be in the 1 to 3 million mark in Europe, up to $10 million, certainly in the US, or significantly higher. One of our clients raised $100 million for its A round, but that is very unusual. But that money has become very difficult to get in Europe, and it is a funding gap, I believe. And that's because, really, of these poor returns of European VCs. 3i pulled out of the market. Nobody's particularly backfilled the hole that 3i left. Great people went to lots of funds like DFJ and Spree and so on. And DFJ, Spree, Index, Bolton, Accel, the list isn't very long. Once you get past about 10 VCs in Europe, then you're really into the super angels. Or what we're now beginning to see are US houses coming over here and investing. So Greycroft led the round into Azimo, for example. And that is a pattern of behaviour I think we'll see more often. I am often amazed if people talk about froth and heat in the market in London, it is nothing compared to what's happening in the US because there are so many VCs. Actually, there's a lot of froth at the product end of businesses in London, but then converting that into a 1 to 5 million A round is quite difficult. Whereas in the US, there are so many VCs. I'm not going to suggest that raising money is ever easy, but once there's a bit of an opportunity that people buy into, then they will be trading term sheets around the VCs, which we don't see so much of over here. But I think there's a huge amount of capital in the US. There's a great range of expertise. And I think what we will begin to see will be offshoot funds. There will be domain knowledge of US investors, certainly significant capital in the US looking for additional growth. And we will see more of that US capital and expertise build out over here. And I think once European VC begins to build a good reputation again, we'll see new entrants into the market because, you know, what is a VC ultimately? It's just an investment manager who's gone out to a series of limited partners, pension funds and so on, to raise money. Once those pension funds, the limited partners, see that they can make good money, then they'll just start to build that back into their portfolio. So the VC environment in Europe will change, and it's certainly beginning to feel, and the stats show this, that it's beginning to look like a proper ecosystem. That's why I think, and Eddie certainly agrees, that we are, you know, 2 or 3 years into this 10-year cycle.
Yes, well, that's very clear and very helpful. And it's quite a good point to move on and wrap up. Time's going by in terms of the future of fintech. I mean, we've spoken about a number of the components that you and I think need to be put in place. And you've given some very useful background in terms of how it works in America and how they're that much further forward. So how do you see the next few years, Richard, for yourself, your firm and the fintech?
Well, I'm certainly not going to advocate that we need a lot of government intervention, far from it. But I do think there is a bit of a role for government to play in making sure that we keep the red tape off the UK, keeping the regulation light, making sure that it is a good place to do business, keeping the tax regime pretty benign. And I think that will attract companies. We are seeing an increasing amount of US companies that are looking to the UK companies, the UK economy. So I think we're going to see a lot more inward investment that we will be spending a lot of time doing. As I said, we are in the London market, we're the number one advisor on AIM by market capitalization, and that's going to be a big feature of the future. We're going to see some really great fintech IPOs. And then the exit market. We are still quite nascent. There's a lot of excitement about the startups and the seed rounds and the A rounds. But what we'll see is we'll see a lot of international growth capital deployed so that companies will scale.
Yeah.
And we very much see ourselves as part of that journey. And then if they don't IPO, there will be some knockouts of the park exits, I think.
Yeah, and obviously, for the core professional, B2B or whatever you want to call it, FS fintech, I'm a great believer in the idea that the best thing that kind of fintech can do is get the best support above the waterline and below the waterline possible. If I had a few million for my fintech, in fact, if I raise 100 million for the London Fintech podcast, how would I spend it? I think after I'd fainted and come round and worried about what on earth I could do with it, then I would spend it on good legal support, good graphic design, good HR, good et cetera, et cetera. And perhaps one of the things, just to sort of end on a note of accessibility maybe, one of the things that might put off your average little fintech is that having listened to you talking now and understanding more of this 360-degree picture that's necessary beyond just the core of an idea and then, oh, I've got a product, they might look at a big firm such as yours and think, God, that's going to be really expensive.
Yeah.
Is that something that you sort of, you know, at a certain stage, fintech firms start calling you and having such chatted to you before?
So we understand you have to get involved in emerging technology as it emerges. So in order to address that issue, we've built something that we call our Jumpstart platform. So in many ways, at the early stages, the company's needs are almost identical to any other company's needs, because actually the nuts and bolts of building a company and getting the blocks in place are very similar. So we've built a suite of free advice, free documents that might only be relevant to the earliest of stage companies, but that means that we can add the value in the areas that are very bespoke to that business, and we have a discounted range of fees for that jumpstart platform.
Good, okay. Well, I think that's quite a good note to end on, Richard. We've been through all the grand nine-figure exits around the world, what London needs, and we end up with the entry-level useful package. And obviously, we all hope that London FinTech develops very well and lots of people are putting lots of effort into it. And there's no reason, if people look around and remove the blinkers and look at their implicit assumptions and the whole thing gets more, quotes, professional, that we can't overtake America. At the same time, I think we don't need to believe our propaganda too much about we're so wonderful in London, because actually those Americans are pretty good at sort of modern capitalism.
Certainly are.
Good. Thanks for that, Richard.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts of new episodes. Live long and prosper.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so grey, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance with me.